I have no doubt that if we could listen tonight to reports of all that God is doing in the world through the missionary efforts of His church, we would be quite astounded. Our breath would be taken away if we could see it all. At this moment, it seems that there is something of a God-sent spiritual awakening going on in the country of Algeria, a Muslim country. And from the reports that we are hearing, large numbers of Algerian Muslims are coming to Jesus Christ. It's beginning to worry the Algerian government, and persecution is beginning. A young Algerian lady was stopped and arrested 2 weeks ago because she was walking in town with her purse, and someone accosted her, obviously knew something, and stopped her and looked in her purse, and there were several Bibles, and she was arrested for having several Bibles because that meant she was proselyting. And it's against the law for a Muslim to convert to Christianity in Algeria. But when young Algerian girls walk around with several Bibles in their purses, something's happening. And not to mention many other places in the world where God is doing amazing things in this day. So we have much to rejoice. His hand is strongly upon the countries of the southern hemisphere of our world, and such that now it's the Ugandan Anglican bishops that are speaking up and keeping others in the Western Hemisphere from being able to completely change the church into an organization that allows homosexuality men among its ministers. But it's the brave and godly men of Africa and other places that believe the scriptures to be inspired, and they can read the scriptures very well. They don't have any of this complicated way of higher criticism and getting around these things. They know it's God's word. They know it's what He really said, and they said, "You can't do this." So it's wonderful. God is at work in our world today, and we pray with all our hearts that He would remember the Western world, that times of refreshing would come again from His hand. Well, tonight I want to talk to you about this matter of planting indigenous, self-supporting, self-governing, self-propagating churches, the three-self formula, as it was called. And this is going to be partially a historical study in missiology. Excuse me for staying close to my notes, because I'm going to talk about people where this came from and who they were and where it was taught and what impact it made and why it's important. And yeah, that's just the way we're going to approach it tonight. In the mid to late 1800s, a new school of thought about how to carry out missions was born. It was a more biblical view. Before that time, missions was most often carried on in this way. The missionaries would arrive in a place. They would set up separate missionary compounds, walled compounds. The missionaries would live upon these compounds. I've lived on one of them in Africa for a year myself before I could get out. But they would evangelize. They would quickly take the most promising converts and take them out of their vocations and make them paid workers, paid by the foreign mission, paid with foreign money to help them in their evangelism and in their church planting. The missionaries would control the work at every point. All of the money would come from the foreign mission. The missionaries would control all of the decisions about how the work was carried on. They would pay the workers, they would build the buildings, they would pay for the buildings, and they would settle in for decades in one place and be responsible for the ultimate maintenance of the whole life and work of the church. I've seen this. still in action, still in place in West Africa. And even when there were national pastors, the missionaries would still be there on the compound. And they would still be there as the big brother, over the shoulder, really pulling the strings and ultimately calling the shots, so to speak. So three things: they stayed around, they provided the money, and they called the shots. We could describe it that way. This is the way missions was done. Bad fruits of these methods. And his book called The Indigenous Church, A Complete Handbook on How to Grow Young Churches, one of the modern writers on this subject, and I'll mention him in a moment, his name is Melvin Hodges, says this: after 15 to 20 years of this type of work, which I've just described, he, the missionary, may wonder why the native church does not show some signs of standing on its own feet. The workers do not manifest any initiative. The people do not show any concern for the salvation of their neighbors, nor manifest a willingness to assume financial responsibility for any phase of the mission. He realizes that his removal from the oversight of the mission would bring the whole project to a standstill unless another missionary took over. What is the reason for this? Simply the plan he has followed. He has treated the people like irresponsible children. He has led them, thought for them, relieved them of all financial responsibility for years. He has unintentionally robbed them of those practical processes which develop strong character in any walk of life, whether in Canada or China, whether white or yellow skin. Actually, he has founded a sort of spiritual hospital over which he must be the chief nurse as long as it remains. His life work has become a liability rather than an asset. He has sown his leadership and domination and provision of every need, and he has reaped the servitude and malnutrition of a community of underdeveloped spiritual children. Strong and vivid statement of a situation, but really not exaggerated in terms of what was really happening during much of the 20th century, in some places still, even though a change in thought had come late in the 1800s and early in the 1900s. Things in some places, this was not discovered, this was not known, this new way of doing things, or not appreciated. And so when I was in Ivory Coast, working for an interdenominational Christian organization, I had the opportunity to travel around to the whole country of Ivory Coast and work with all of the major denominations. I met the pastors, I worked with them in evangelism training and evangelistic campaigns. We brought students. It was a student ministry I was involved in. We would bring students and we would put them at the, like go team, so to speak, and we would put them at the disposition of churches, and in that way I was able to be familiar with these situations, to go to these compounds in the extreme north of the country, in the east, in the west, in the south. And what I noticed that gave me so much pain was that in so many of these places, it seemed that there was an incredible lethargy or lethargy. I don't know how to pronounce these words anymore. In French, you give the same emphasis across all the syllables, so you don't have a problem. I'm American in Great Britain. I'm having trouble here. Trying to get my way out of it. But anyway, so in these places, meeting these pastors, no dynamic, no joy in the ministry, no initiative. I felt like I was getting them out of bed when I arrived and would talk to them about the plans for the evangelism. Except among one denomination, it was completely different: the Assemblies of God. Now, I couldn't understand this until I began to learn about these things, and I realized Melvin Hodges, who I've just quoted, was an Assemblies of God pastor, and has written extensively on this new thought. And evidently, from what I've understood in my research, he's greatly influenced the methodology of the Assemblies of God missions worldwide. In fact, so influential and well-known is he in the denomination that most people in the Assemblies of God think that Melvin Hodges is the originator of the three-self formula. Whereas he only went to the mission field in about 1930, and these things began in the late 1800s. But the situation I saw with the Assemblies of God in Ivory Coast was when I arrived in the different cities where they were, there was no missionary to be found, no white missionary. There were only the African pastors. And these African pastors, they were men of stature. When you met them, you realized you were in the presence of someone who ran things right away, who had authority, who was spoken about with great respect among the congregations when you spoke to them. They were big churches. There were things happening, and it was completely different. But you never could find a white Assemblies of God missionary. And the reason was they had followed this methodology. They had laid the foundation, and as soon as possible, they had decreased so that their nationals may increase. And so these men were tried men. They had been challenged. They had had the challenges laid on their shoulders. They had learned initiative. They had learned to struggle with God about issues of faith. And when there wasn't enough money, they couldn't look to the missionary and say, we need some more. They had to get down on their knees and pray about it and deal with God about it and teach about giving. And they had to take the things into their hand, and character and strength and faith were developed in this way. And I believe that this is the explanation of part of the explanation of what I saw. Because there were other denominations in Ivory Coast that had the same theology as the Assemblies of God, and yet did not have the same dynamic and national-led ministry. Well, let me tell you about a little history of what seems to me to be this rediscovery of more biblical principles. In 1796, two men were born, one in Great Britain and one in America. One's name was Rufus Anderson, and he was born in the state of Maine in the USA, and the other's name was Henry Venn, and he was born in Great Britain. The interesting thing in God's providence is that each lost his mother at the age of 7, each lost his father at the age of 17, each was the eldest son in the family, each graduated from college in 1818, each served as senior secretary in an important mission agency. For Anderson, it was the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. For Venn, it was the Church Missionary Society of the Anglican Church. Both became famous for their work as missions directors, and both were given credit for formulating the so-called indigenous church principles: self-supporting, self-governing, self-propagating. They both emphasized these three principles, and evidently each came to this three-cell formula without collusion with the other. Together they provided a new and more biblical direction for world missions by holding these three concepts together as essential. Now, Anderson focused a bit more on the development of indigenous leadership, national leadership, and Venn was a bit more preoccupied with the financial aspect of it, making sure that you didn't finance the things for the church plant, but that they had to be self-financing. Yet, for both, the goal of missions was the spread of scriptural self-propagating churches. Churches that would themselves become the means for the further missionary advance. Okay. The next person we need to talk about is John Nevius, who I mentioned this afternoon. John Nevius was an American missionary to China with the Presbyterian Missionary Board. He was a reformed man. He's well known for a book called Demon Possession and Allied Themes, which is the classic reform book on the subject of demon possession. You can find it sometimes on the used markets, an old copy of it. It's a very, very interesting book. Nevius picked up these ideas from Anderson and Venn, and he began to teach them. And notably, he began to teach them systematically in 1890 on a trip to Korea. He was a missionary in China, but on a trip to Korea, he taught these things very systematically, and they were adopted by the Presbyterian missionaries in Korea, and a vigorous church rapidly developed there, which was virtually unmatched in the history of missions in the non-Western world. You may know something about the Presbyterian missions in Korea, the revivals and all the rest. It's a great, great story. Nevius was more strict in his application of the self-support principle. He insisted, as a general rule, that nationals not be hired with missions funds, which Anderson would allow a little bit. But the methods began to be called the Nevius method of Korea. People didn't quite realize afterwards that it was Anderson and Venn that had really been the first to talk about these things, because the success in Korea using these methods made Nevius very popular. As far as we're concerned now, if you've ever heard of these things, you've probably heard of them through the writing of Roland Allen. Roland Allen was a Church of England missionary who served in China from 1895 to 1903. And he's the one who wrote the most famous book on the subject, which is called Paul's Missionary Methods or Ours. He wrote some other books too, but this book was the book that became widely known, and lots of people read it. Now, Allen was a bit caustic. In my opinion, didn't have very much nuance in his teaching. It was black and white. But the important contribution that he made to this whole thing was the idea of the dynamic of the Holy Spirit in the development of indigenous churches. And Allen believed that the tendency of missionary agencies to hesitate to leave young churches to support, govern, and propagate themselves was because of lack of understanding and faith in the ministry of the Holy Spirit. And he went to the New Testament, and he felt that here we had a picture of Paul's great trust in the sovereign and effective ministry of the Holy Spirit. And that this was something that missionaries often felt, oh, we can't leave this in the hands of the Africans. They'll never be able to do that. They'll never be able to understand the doctrine that well and to teach it and to do this and to do that. And it was simply a very God-dishonoring lack of confidence in the ministry of the Spirit of God. So this was the contribution that he made to the whole subject. More recently, Melvin Hodges, as I said, he went to Central America. Actually, it was 1935, and he's written several books on this topic in a more modern style. So if you're ever interested in these things, I would say try to find a used copy of Nevius. I can't remember the exact title of his book, but John Nevius, if you put Indigenous Churches, Church Planning, Indigenous Church Planning, John Nevius, you may be able to find something on the subject. It's a short book. It's not very big. It might be interesting to get one of Hodges' books too, because he's an excellent writer, and he understands these principles very well, and I don't think necessarily that you would see the Pentecostalism coming out in his books on church planting. Now, so the general thesis is this, that the Apostle Paul tailored his church planting methods to the conscious goal of establishing indigenous churches that he could leave after a very limited time, and which would be able to govern themselves, provide for themselves, and spread the gospel farther themselves. That he had this conscious goal, that this was the sort of church that he wanted to plant, and that his methods must lead to that goal and not frustrate that goal. So the three selves, and let me just say them once again, self-propagating, that means we want to plant churches that have sufficient vitality to spread the gospel through their own region by their own efforts and even farther. Secondly, self-governing, we want to raise churches and plant churches that are governed by men raised up by the Spirit of God among the converts of that locality. And self-supporting, we want to plant churches that do not depend on foreign money in order to stand up, to remain standing. Those three things. What do we see in Paul's methods that was calculated to produce that sort of church, those three selves? Again, I'll quote from Hodges, and then I want to simply talk about things that we must do in each of these three areas if we want the churches we plant. And I'm really talking mostly about cross-cultural church planting, okay? Some of the things I'll say you won't be able to really shift over into your home missions situation, okay? We're talking about planting churches in another culture and seeing a national church raise up in that culture. But let me quote Hodges again. He says this about Paul. After preaching the gospel in the city, the converts were brought together in a convenient meeting place, often the home of a believer, and other times in any public location that might be available to them. We all know all of this, such as a synagogue or a school. These groups of believers would meet together at regular intervals for worship and instruction in Christian doctrine and conduct. Elders and deacons would be chosen from among the number to provide the necessary leadership and ministry as they witnessed to their townspeople and the surrounding area. Paul was in Thessalonica only a few weeks, yet he left the church established in that place. He labored in Ephesus for 2 years, teaching in the school of Tyrannus. As a result, all the province of Asia, in Asia Minor, heard the word of the Lord. Now listen to this, please. Paul evidently made no appeals for workers from Jerusalem or Antioch to come and fill the pastorates of the churches which he had planted in Asia Minor, in Galatia, in Macedonia, and Achaia. And there was no financial appeal made to either Antioch or Jerusalem for support for workers or for the building of church buildings. Well, you know, have church building, as far as the record shows. Rather, we found the apostle taking up offerings among these new missionary churches to help the saints of the mother church in Jerusalem when that region was stricken with famine. Also, Paul taught not just in a way that believers could understand, but also in a way that they could teach it to others in their turn. So let's, I just want to give you some practical ideas, and we'll start with self-governing, planting self-governing churches. What must we do? And I want to just read a few points out and maybe discuss them a little bit. Number one. Make a priority of evangelizing and working with heads of families whenever possible. Teach them how to lead their families and make decisions. From day one in France, I have prayed and prayed and prayed, Lord, give me the men. Give me the men of the families. Not that I don't want the women, but the problem is often that the women are more easily contacted. And we see often the women coming and the men aren't around. Take the men witnessing to relatives and friends and show them how to do it. Involve suitable men as soon as possible in leadership activities, leading public services, leading prayer meetings or Bible studies. Sometimes as Reformed people, we can wait a little bit too long before we give any man anything to do. He almost has to be ordained to lead a Bible study. And this certainly is not right. We know that ordination is necessary and for certain functions and positions in the local church, but certainly we can train up men to do lots of things who aren't ordained men or aren't elders. And through this responsibility, they may become men apt to be elders or pastors. Involve chosen key men in decision-making processes from the beginning. Consult with them. Have them make decisions. Let them know it is their church and not yours. There are many decisions from the beginning that don't take a deep spiritual knowledge. When we started in Grenoble, I asked the French men, where should we plant this church in the valley? Where's the need? What are the towns like in the valley? What's the different characteristics? And bringing them in on all these sorts of things. And their understanding that I'm here to help you, but this is your show. This is your church. I won't be here forever. Make it clear to the church that your aim is to leave them with their own leadership as soon as possible. And again, as soon as I began the ministry in Grenoble and we had gathered a group and there were worship services, I let them know that my main priority was to replace myself with a Frenchman, that I was aiming straight at it as soon as I can, as soon as God will allow that to happen. 6, encourage the building of relationships apart from the missionary and his family. The missionary is not the center, and he shouldn't be all dominating in terms of the friendships and relationships. The missionary should be happy when there are families that become very close friends, closer with one another than him. Relationships and friendships develop that way. One will be closer to another, and the missionary will do well to see the Lord knit the hearts of certain believers to others. Have church officers brought in by church vote as soon as possible. Don't delay unduly over that matter. I have been helping a church in Wetzlar, Germany for several years that is about 15 years old. Never had an elder. They never could choose an elder because no man was perfect enough for their criteria. So finally, one time, when excellent men there, excellent men who knew the confession of faith, who were raising their families very well, who had abilities in teaching, everything you'd want. But they had pitched the level so high. So one time when I went, I said, well, I'm going to preach from, I guess it was 1 Corinthians 4. Sorry for taking this one out of context, but it says, do not exceed what is written, Paul says. I've written these things to you about me and Apollos so that you might not learn to go beyond what is written. And I said, dear brothers, in this matter of eldership, are you going beyond what is written? Are you requiring things that even Scripture doesn't require? And we can do that as missionaries. We must be careful as a sending church to help our missionaries to be balanced in this matter. We want to require all that Paul requires in 1 Timothy and Titus, but we don't want to exceed what is written. Make the drawing up of church statues a corporate venture. When we did it in Grenoble, we spent hours together working over this. I provided them with a basic document for our church statues, but they were in on it because of the context and the different legal things in France about associations and churches and other matters where their own input would be vital. They were essential to the process. If you exercise pastoral and preaching functions, let it be clear to the church that this is a temporary interim provision. They should be thinking in this way all the time. Otherwise, they're just going to think, we got a great pastor. This is wonderful. And they're not going to be praying about anything. They'll be praying about God raising up a man or thinking about becoming that man if they're one of the men. Because you've not taught them to do that. Now, developing self-supporting churches. Self-supporting churches. In the New Testament, we see three things about Paul. The first is that he did not seek financial help for himself from the churches that he ministered to. But I'm not setting that down as a principle. He said he had the right to. He said he wanted to offer the gospel freely. In some cases, a missionary may be wise not to take money from the church he's, not to receive support from a church that he's planting. Until 2 years ago, I did this in Grenoble. I explained to someone that the reason why I did it was there are many churches in France that are stuck with a missionary forever. And the reason why is simple. They started with a missionary. They got a building, a rental situation. Rent is very high in some places. They're paying 1,500 euros a month. They're small churches. When you're paying 1,500 euros a month to rent a building, you're just throwing away that money, and you don't have enough to pay the salary of a pastor. You never will. Unless, in God's grace, the church triples in size. So these churches, I've seen them go year after year after year after year, and they're completely dependent on foreign support, on foreign money. So from the beginning, we said, we'll meet in a house. Don't support me. I want you to give, but give the money, and we're going to try as soon as possible to buy facilities for you, buy your own facilities. So 6 years down the road, the church was able to pay cash down, no loan, buy a building for 125,000 euros, and that was 30 people who were doing this. And so we have our own building, and now the church has saved up about 30,000 euros for the first French pastor to be able to perhaps make a down payment on a manse, or at least have 3 or 4 years or 2 years salary eventually when he arrives, so that even though they're small, he'll have at least a number of years where he can minister and build the church and make it grow so that it's to a point where it can easily support him with no problem. So there may be reasons for a missionary to say, no, don't give me support. The church is gradually taking on some of my support to learn to bear that burden of their pastoral care. It's important. But that's one issue to consider. Paul did not bring money to his converts. Each church that he founded immediately became financially independent. The only exception was a collection of funds from the churches he founded for the famine-stricken saints in Jerusalem. Or special need because of a famine, that's a different sort of issue. The churches administered their own funds. It's interesting to notice that even when Paul goes to Jerusalem with the money from the churches in Asia Minor, he doesn't carry the money. He asks for one of the brethren from those mission churches to come with him. It's their money. They're going to administer it. Interesting. He's developing that sense of responsibility all along the way, even in these small things, in matters of money. The wrong use of finances makes new churches dependent and weak. It's like taking a wild animal and raising him in your house, and your children feed him, and they provide everything for him, all the food he needs. You're providing it artificially, and what happens to that animal? He's weak. He's unable to fend for himself. He's not self-supporting, so to speak. And that's what we sometimes render a church tame by the way we provide wrongly for its needs from foreign support. The strange thing is there are mission-supported churches in certain cities in the world of the third country that are still utterly dependent, while in the same cities there are churches that are financially independent and have an outreach ministry. And they're in the same situation with the same poverty, and yet nationals fully support one church, and the other church would not last 6 months without the foreign money coming in. Really interesting situation, isn't it? Financial paternalism, providing all the money, stifles local initiative. Haiti is a good example. Haiti is one of the poorest countries in the world. I often wonder if one of the reasons is that one of the poorest countries in the world is it's received so much generous foreign aid. Instead of teaching them to fish, we've given them fish, and it's developed an attitude, a mindset of dependence. Providing foreign funds for the missions church is dangerous to the worker himself. We develop faith when we're put to the test, don't we? And if we never have to depend upon God for finances, we don't mature. We depend on the mission board. Another problem is that it tends to curtail and limit outreach, because outreach depends on the pipeline of foreign funds, and when the budget is already reached, it just means we can't do anything, because we only do something when the money comes in from overseas. Whereas if we've learned to depend upon God and to give, then we say, brethren, we need funds to do such and such. And we trust God to see funds raised up. It also tends to separate people who have money from those who don't. So-and-so is supported by the mission, such-and-such national pastor. I'd like to be supported by the mission. It also implies that the national believers are inferior. There was a seminary in Africa where all the students received full scholarships from North American donors to do their studies. Terrible idea. I'm teaching regularly in a seminary in Burkina Faso now, and very, very poor country. And all the students have to make their own way, and they do it. I don't know how they do it. Don't know. I have no idea how they make it. But the Lord provides for them. Provides for them. They have to come in all from all over the country a few times a year for the courses. They're already pastors, untrained pastors, African situation. But they learn to trust God. The Christians that are in their congregations give what little money they can, give them a goat, give them something, and it's done. But in this situation, these students received full scholarship from North American donors, and in return, they had to write prayer letters to these anonymous donors put prayer requests. And they begin to ask, are Africans the only ones who need prayer? Our North American donors never send us letters with their prayer requests. Isn't that an interesting situation to set up? A spiritual paternalism. No wonder they have an inferiority complex spiritually. We've taught them that they're the ones that need us to pray for them. So, in summary, these sort of things tend to produce rice Christians also. Rice Christians are those who are false converts, and they came because of all the money that's available through the foreign mission, and they realize they might get in on it. And it's not always totally conscious. Some of it in our sinful hearts is in the subconscious. Methods to encourage self-support. What do we do practically? Five things. Teach on giving. Oblige the church to provide for its own building, pay its own salary, it's the pastor's salary, once it has its national pastor, and even take on support of the missionary gradually over time. I know Mr. Elliott had a scheme in place in which each year the church plant took on a greater percent of his salary, and England supported less. It's one way to do it. Have the church adopt a budget from the beginning and manage it. Let the church manage its own budget. Have the church set up a building fund and also a fund to provide for the future support of a pastor when he comes. Tithe, teach the church to tithe on its giving to missions. Teach the church 10% of what comes in the collection plate goes out to foreign missions, somewhere beyond our borders. French people have a terrible time, if left to themselves, of being missions-minded. And the simple reason is they consider that they are the missions field. And they are. They are. But they are also a missionary force. They're called. They're part of the commission to go to all the nations And some French missionaries have done great things. They're out there now. But we have to, in this matter of finances, we need to teach the church to give to missions, to be giving also. Now, developing self-propagating churches. We've talked about self-governing and self-supporting, self-propagating churches. And I have 7 points I want to more or less read out on that. Teach that all believers have the solemn duty and great privilege to be Christ's witness. Teach them how to witness. And show them by taking them with you or inviting them over. When you're inviting non-Christians to a meal, invite some of the believers over. And when you turn the conversation to the things of the gospel, you're doing a training session at the same time in the most informal, natural, and relaxed way. Because this is probably how they're going to witness most is around their dinner table. So do it there in front of them. Show them how. We've had some wonderful times. Then I turn to Pascal and say, Pascal, what would you say in answer to that question of so-and-so? Now he's on the spot. He's going to have to answer it. And so you got him into it. Yeah. This is a wonderful way to do it. But you can take them out on go teams, and you can do beach witnessing. You can do door-to-door for those who may have the gifts to do that. Not everyone can go door-to-door. My poor grandmother, who only had 2 years of primary school, loved the Lord, but she'd never be able to go door to door. She couldn't. She wouldn't have the courage to stand up in front of four people gathered together. But so we don't force everyone to do everything. But those who are able to, we can have them do these sorts of things. Have regular evangelistic thrusts and activities that involve their participation. There are all sorts of ways to do it. Special services in which you've printed up invitations and they're giving the invitations to their friend and talking about, we're going to have such and such meeting. And it's a wonderful thing because often they've wanted to talk to that person about the gospel somehow but had never done it. And just giving the invitation is a way to say, I'm a Christian. We're having a meeting and it's about this. And even if the person doesn't come, now the door's open to go farther. You can have them help you with a literature stand. We have open-air markets in France and literature stands, and I've had people come to the stand with me and help me to give out literature and talk to people and answer questions. Go teams and all sorts of things that you can do, but getting the people, every evangelistic outthrust, the whole church should feel that we are mobilized, that I'm going to be doing something to bring the gospel to those around me in my circle. And I'm going to pray like crazy for boldness to do it and thrust myself upon the Lord. Acquaint the young church with good evangelistic literature that they can give to friends. My church knows because at some points in our life, I did a little commercial, a little advertisement before the worship service. And I'm always very clear about it. I say, before we start our worship service, I want to present a couple of books to you. Present the books, then I sit down, have a moment of silence and getting ready for the service, and there's a break, and they know, okay, now we're going to start the service. But they're all there, and I've got them as a captive audience, and I say, now, if you want to witness to a Catholic, well, if there's some Catholics there, I'd say it in a different way. But anyway, here's a good book for a person that has such and such and such and such question. And so they get to know that here are 2, 3, 4 books, good evangelistic literature, and here's the situation in which I use them. And then they start borrowing them from the church library to read first, and then they start buying copies, and then they know what to use for what sort of person. I think this is very important to do with our congregation. If they're young in the faith and they don't know much about Christian literature. Pray in prayer meetings for evangelistic opportunities and for unsaved friends. Well, these are very simple things, aren't they? But they're things we've got to do. People, the young converts must be praying for their own friends by name and for opportunities to witness. Have prayer meetings for overseas missions. We do it, as I said, once a month on a Sunday. I think I said this. We have Sunday evening. We have our evening meeting is prayer for the nations. So we have someone present two countries, give us the statistics, look them up, tell us about the country, what are the spiritual needs, what are the challenges, how many Christian, evangelical Christians are there, show us the map, always looking at maps, we want to know where they are, and every month we must have prayed for, oh, I would say between 100 and 150 countries together over the weeks of this church plant. But they're learning by doing this that we are concerned about the whole world, the whole world. We're a propagating church. We can't go yet, but we're going in spirit. We're going in prayer. And so the idea one day of this church sending out someone will not be a strange idea to them, because their whole life they've been praying for it. Their whole life they've been hearing about others that went there and what they were doing and how wonderful it was. And so we're teaching the church to be self-propagating by all of these things. Tozer says about R.A. Jeffrey that I mentioned, the missionary to Southeast Asia that I mentioned Wednesday night, that he watched over the young church plants in Asia as Paul watched over his converts in Galatia and Thessalonica. And always he kept before them the idea that they must spread out, that they must move on over the next river, over the next mountain, to contact more and yet more souls for Christ. Self-propagating. And of course, the more we teach them and the more we love them, and the more they understand the glory of the gospel, the more they'll want to take it to everyone that they can. So, we've talked about self-governing, self-supporting, self-propagating. There's one more thing that we must say, and that is we must develop churches that not only are these three selves, but are also really indigenous. There have been missionaries that have founded churches on the mission field that are self-propagating, self-governing, and self-financing. But they've been very Western churches, and because of that fact, they've been unable to really reproduce churches that would really be national churches and grow in that soil. Now, here's what I mean. If we have a banana plant in South America or in Ivory Coast, we had lots of banana plants. If you have a banana plant, because it's indigenous, because it's native to that land, you plant it, and if it has water, it's going to grow and bear fruit. And there is water. The conditions are just right. It's made to grow there. If you take your banana plant to Northern Ireland and you plant it in your backyard, will it grow and bear fruit? Well, you're going to have to take special care of it, aren't you? You're going to have to do special things. You're going to uproot it or plant it in a pot and bring it in during the winter and do all sorts of things that are very artificial. And maybe then it'll stay alive, but I doubt it'll produce any fruit. And the problem is sometimes in missions, missionaries have planted churches that are foreign. In this sense, that they are structures and organisms that depend on something that is not present in that land, in that culture, but is present back home. Let me give you just one example that's true. This fellow was a missionary. I don't remember what country, a third world country, a poor country. And he did a lot of evangelism from village to village. He taught his national Christians to do evangelism and exhorted them to do this village-to-village work. But they never would do it. When he wasn't around in a certain region, he found that the Christians of the churches in that region, they weren't doing it. Now, he was really zealous about this, gave a great example. He would go from village to village on his four-wheel drive truck, okay, doing his evangelism. And one day he finally asked him, well, why aren't you doing this? And they said, we don't have a 4x4 truck. That's what they told him. He sold the 4x4 truck, and he started going to village from village to village on a bicycle. And they all started doing it too. Now it's indigenous, because you see, it's a native plant. Everything that's being done is being done with what they have there. And the situation has completely changed. This is a really vital thing. You know, you could build a church with a steeple in Mali, but you'd have to bring the steeple from, you see what I'm saying? The style of the architecture of the church building, everything needs to be as native as native can be, so that we can reproduce it without ever seeing the missionary again. With what we have here, with what we are here, with the things we know how to do, and the way we do things. So these are the principles that changed the way, that took the missionaries off the mission compounds and began to develop a dynamic way of doing missions that was much more biblical. And really, really, one of the great issues was based on a greater trust in God. Was based on a greater trust that God can work within the African people, the Sri Lankan people, just as powerfully as through me. He can give them wisdom. He can give them gifts of preaching. He can give gifts of administration. He can teach them to pray and trust God and see God provide funds. He can do all the things that He does for us, and He must do them all for them, and they must be thrust upon Him for them. So I think this is the main thing that began to bring blessing to this way of doing things. Whatever is faith is not a faith, is sin. So I'm going to stop there, and maybe, shall we, Samuel, so we have some questions, or, okay, well.